Thanks for tuning into our podcast. We love having you here, and it's our mission to bring you all the latest and greatest tips, skills, and know-how to make you the best that you can be. We know that you have it in you, and we're going to show you how. Now, let's get started.
Hi again, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the Consistently Fit Podcast. My name's Jim Burns. As you know, we were once anti-bullying 101, and we are still dealing with bullying. There's no question about it. But right now, we believe that we want to get people fit. I had quadruple bypass surgery about a year and a half ago, and I was in the process, if you can believe it, of studying to be a certified personal trainer, which I ended up becoming. I became a personal trainer. But then it started to dawn on me that we have unhealthy schools, and they're unhealthy in four areas: the physical, the mental, the social, emotional, and the spiritual areas. And what we want to do is we want to use this podcast as a venue to help others become fit in those areas, because what I've discovered, you got a lot of angry kids, you got a lot of angry adults, but you know, when they're feeling pretty good about themselves physically and emotionally and mentally, what happens is they're kinder, they're more caring, and they certainly don't bully. So that's our goal. That's our plight. We're going to see what we can do with the podcast to make sure that that happens. And today, we have a great guy with us. We were talking before we started, and he's doing unbearably good work. His name is Forrest, and it's got to be the same thing. Bronze, correct?
Bronzen.
Forrest Bronzen. And Forrest is an entrepreneur, speaker, and founder of and CEO of Camp Light, and board member of Digital Detox, where he leads global initiatives for digital wellness. He has a customer base in over 70 countries and a deep passion for improving the relationship society has with technology. Hats off. Forrest travels the world to better understand how technology impacts our lives. And it does. Whether you want to believe it or not, it does. And at Camp Light, Forrest strives to help parents navigate raising kids in a digital age, where he works with a team of psychologists to provide parents with the proper resources and safe spaces to deal with bullying and other tech concerns. And there's a whole lot more. But Forrest, welcome to the show.
Jim, thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. You know, and we'll get into some of the deeper questions, but you know what I've discovered? I find that parents, you could present all this to them, but what happens is they see it as like they're fighting a losing battle. Like you can't stop it. They always have the phone in their hand, the kids, like it's an appendage of an extension of their arm. And they feel like they fight a losing battle, and they throw their hands in the air and give up. Have you noticed any of that stuff?
Yeah, from pretty much all ages, right? So it's a small subset of the parent base. And for context, we work with parents on the digital detox side in probably 90 countries now, and it's consistent everywhere. It doesn't matter if you're rich or poor, or, you know, where you live, you're struggling with technology and you're struggling with parenting technology. And to your point, Jim, yeah, at a very young age, parents are, you know, whether it's giving in or not knowing how to deal with this uncharted territory, that might be a better description. Mm-hmm. They're struggling. You know, I think it's more difficult at an older age for parents, I think, to, you know, foster an environment that has some balance. At a younger age, they have a lot more control, right? Mm-hmm. The you know, children look up to them in a different way and mm-hmm. kind of respect them in a different way. And that's why it needs to start at a very early age, modeling that behavior and kind of setting the framework for, you know, as a family, how we're going to approach this thing called technology.
Yeah. I have discovered, you know, I have a daughter, 33, another one, 27 or 28. And then we have Zoe. And my kids, the older ones, we didn't have cell phones. Cell phones, I'm going to say cell phones came around for me like 2000, 2001. That's when I got my first cell phone. My older kids didn't get theirs till much later. So there wasn't this opportunity, and I've seen it, for parents to use the cell phone as a babysitter. In other words, you're in a car. It used to be you got to play with stuff in the car. You had a rattle. You had something. Kid starts acting up. Give him the phone. Let him look at some of the YouTube videos or whatever the case may be. And I find that we introduce it. We introduce that technology to that kid who's 2 years old, sitting in a thing, sitting in a car seat, but we give him the phone. And I don't think it happens quite as much now, but we didn't realize it was like feeding kids, you know, McDonald's French fries. Once you introduce it, you can't stop it. It's almost impossible to stop.
Well, yeah, so I have an analogy later. I want to get back to junk food, but let's save that for later because it's going to crescendo and we need to set some context first. So yeah, no, we see that across the board. And, you know, a couple comments. One, I think you can find that balance though. Yes. And, you know, digital detox, we're not anti-technology. I think there's some great uses of screens for families, for individuals, for elementary school kids, for sure. But it doesn't have to be constant. And to your point where parents are like, I don't know what to do. I have to give in. We work with a lot of parents, let's call it, you know, kindergarten through fifth graders. And that shouldn't happen. Look, like you're the parent. And at the end of the day, you get to set the parameters for when they get screen time, right? You know, and if they're watching it in their room and you don't want them to watch it in the room, you have the agency to set those ground rules and to teach those best practices. And mm-hmm. it needs to happen earlier. So yeah, but we see that time and time again, where we're kind of giving in and using it as a babysitter. That said, one important point is there are situations where, you know, we kind of always look at, you know, what's the alternative. So in some cases, you just have to pick, you know, the lesser of two evils. If it's the mm-hmm. difference between mom or dad getting the job interview to put food on the table or having better screen time, of course. Yeah. If you need to do it to get this done, like that's life. Like it's messy and it's complicated. It's unfortunate that, you know, that we have to have so many screens, but that said, like there's going to be situations where it's okay. And I think we need to have, you know, more empathy for everyone. That said, I think for the majority of parents, they overdo it. They don't think about it in that way. And they do kind of use it as a crutch.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, you make a great point when you said you're the parent. And I think that we have to convince parents that they are the parent. Because, you know, I'm not going to get into anything on parenting right now, although I've taught a lot on parenting. I'm 70 years old. So I, you know, I figured, you know what, as a retired administrator, I can go off and teach some of this stuff. But it's very hard to convince a parent that they're the parent when they find that they keep failing over and over again. You know, you tell a kid not to do something, he does it anyway. Disrespect, irresponsibility all over the map, and it becomes difficult for him. So the work that you do with parents is something that I find to be also really admirable and helping them.
No, I appreciate that. I think the challenge is no one wants to hear how to parent, right? No one wants someone else to tell them you're doing this wrong or you need to improve this. It's that takes a very strong parent to be open to that outside criticism. You made a good point in your kind of opening line though, that, you know, parents are, they have so much pressure to kind of give in and say, you know, here's the iPhone, here's the social media, whatever it is. I think that pressure gets even more difficult as the child ages. So, you know, when you're in middle school, high school, you have so much different social pressure. When you're in kindergarten through fifth grade, that's when you have, I mean, don't get me wrong, you should have the agency to be the parent at any age, but it only gets more difficult. So if you're having trouble setting boundaries in second grade, it's going to get much harder. So I would practice those skills as a parent at a younger age, so you're set up for success as your child evolves.
That's a great point. That's an absolutely outstanding point. So you talked about this idea of balance. So how can technology be used to either help or hinder? What are some of the things that we can do? Say, hey, this is great. We'll use technology. I've got to be honest with you. The day of paper and pencil's over. It's over. I think they should have one day a week where they do paper and pencil. But the kids are, I mean, you could literally go away for a week and not miss anything in school as long as you complete everything that's on that Chromebook. And I find that amazing, amazing. And it's a good deal. And at times it's not such a great deal because the kids get used to this idea that, I don't have to be there. I can get caught up pretty easy. And so what are some ways that technology can help or hinder our kids?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think it really depends on the age, right? You know, a second grader is very different than a ninth grader. You know, in high school, we're talking about, you know, the debate on ChatGPT. How can we use it in a healthy, smart way? How does it hinder our development? And, you know, at a younger age, it's all about kind of screen time and content and learning apps. To kind of set a broad framework, you know, a question that used to always come up is how much screen time is okay. And that still actually comes up. And parents are hoping for just some magical answer. And I hate to be the bearer of bad news. There's no one knows a specific, no one can give you an exact answer. It's not 2 hours or 1 hour or 10 hours. And if someone is telling you that, like I wouldn't really trust that source just because it's impossible to pinpoint. It's so dependent on the child, on the family, and the dynamic. And I'll give you an example. You know, if we're working with, let's say a fifth grader, right? And, you know, the question is how many hours should they be allowed on screens? Well, let's ask some different questions. What's that child doing? What's their overall kind of portfolio of activity? Mm-hmm. Child A is very involved. They're, you know, meeting their academic requirements, their social emotional requirements, their extracurricular, their athletic, they're involved in activities. They're getting their homework done on time. Everything's being met. Screens are probably actually a good thing for that child to have a little downtime. It's okay to watch, you know, we need to be bored. We need to have some dull moments in life. And a screen could be like really entertaining to just unwind after that very vigorous day. Mm-hmm. Now take child B that isn't meeting their expectations on grades. They're not involved in any extracurriculars. They're not exercising. They're not meeting other requirements. Well, the answer for that child is probably zero screen time, right? Mm-hmm. Or near zero. So it's so dependent on the child. And the next thing that we harp on a little bit is it's less about amount of time, and that's still valuable. Again, like I don't want a fifth grader on a screen for 10 hours a day. Don't get me wrong, but it's more the content, right? You know, I would much rather. So my son's in fourth grade. I would much rather him spend 3 hours watching this documentary on astronomy than flipping through random YouTube or TikTok, of course. You know, so we need to be asking the question, you know, more holistically, you know, what's the dynamic of the child? And then what are they doing on the screen? So that was like a broad answer of kind of thinking through things like screen time. In terms of good uses, you know, I think what frustrates us at Digital Detox sometimes is people demonize screens. Oh my goodness, like I love watching a movie with my son. Like that's just a great pastime. Big bowl of popcorn on a Friday night. That's fun. I think that's a great use for us to bond and laugh and enjoy. We play Mario Kart. It's fun. It's enjoyable. Like screens aren't always the bad guy. That said, they could certainly be overused. Mm-hmm. Now, when we're talking about school, I think learning apps, that's a whole different, we could spend a whole podcast talking about that. And there's some good ones. There's some ones that are very problematic. I think the challenge is that developers have gotten so good at creating kind of gamified experiences that hook you in. They hijack parts of the brain to make it interesting, but at the sacrifice of actually learning. So there's so many math learning apps that, yes, it's going to be fun. The kid's going to play it for a long time so they could, you know, pass the level or win the prize, but they're not actually learning the fundamentals. Mm-hmm. That said, you know, for some kids and some subjects, you know, there probably are some benefits. Think of, you know, astronomy or anatomy. There's probably, you know, a much easier and more engaging experience on an iPad than in a textbook. you know, for those specific things. So it just kind of depends. Mm-hmm. And once we get into, you know, different age, once we get into high school, whole different playing field, right? Now we're talking about, you know, how do we use AI in a smart way? What are the good and bad uses? And the answer with any of this is it's gray, right? There's going to be bad actors that could get a hold of things and have it problematic, but then that exact same tool could get in good hands and be used for really great productivity and really great learning.
Mm-hmm. I love that word. I teach a course in brain compatible methods in the classroom. And I love that word hijacked, because it doesn't take much for a kid to get distracted. It really doesn't. And once they get distracted, to try and bring them back into the fold, it's almost like you need a one of those dogs that just, like, they're herding dogs. You got to keep herding them in, you know, keeping them with the content of the class. But if they can get distracted by something, and that's why I've never been a big fan of allowing phones in school, because I think that they do get distracted. They really do. I mean, they're looking at their phone, and I know they're sneaking it while the teacher's teaching too. They don't take phones anymore. 25 years ago, when I was working as an administrator, we took phones. That was it. You don't need to have a phone. But with the advent of 9/11 and all the other things that went on, we let them have the phone. And that's just the way it is. And the kids do have phones in school. And there's really nothing that we can do other than monitor the use. And you can't. So you start setting rules. You can't have it, you know, during class. You can have it in the cafeteria. You can do it here. It's got to go in your locker here. It got to do this. And that becomes another job for administrators and teachers.
Yeah, no, and we could spend a whole episode talking about phones in schools, and we work with a lot of schools around the country helping kind of develop policy and audit, you know, what they're currently working on. And it's a challenge because a lot of times parents push back and don't agree with the school system. Another thing that comes up is, like, let's say everyone's aligned. Okay, we you know, don't want phones in the classroom. What happens sometimes is, you know, let's say it's a classroom of 30 kids and you have 4 kids that then are culprits and they're constantly looking on their phone. The distraction for the teacher then to enforce the rule and have them put it back is distracting for the rest of the class. And so sometimes some schools just chalk it up to, like, okay, those 4 kids, it's going to be more disruptive to enforce the policy than to just let them do their thing. But that's in a case where it's, you know, 4 out of 30. Once you get into, you know, higher numbers, then yeah, it's wildly distracting. And most students report, so we have an assessment that schools license and give out to students called the Student DORA Score. Most students report that other students' phone use is impacting their learning and impacting their focus. So they're recognizing it. And it's frustrating. But yeah, to your point, it's messy and every school is inconsistent. Some districts enforce it at the district level. Some rely on the school. Some schools don't even enforce it at the school level, but they rely it on the teacher. And then that's a big mess because every teacher is inconsistent. So the math teacher is like, okay, you could use phones. Other teachers like zero phones. So it's messy and it doesn't need to be. I feel like this should be something, you know, I think there could be a lot of healthy debate in other areas of technology. How much time should we give social media, all this other stuff? But like phones in the classroom, there isn't any positive study showing a benefit of that. Mm-hmm. Outside of if it's a very specific class, let's say a digital photography on the phone class, right? Of course, that's an outlier. But yeah, this should be something I think that schools, students, and parents align on. Look, the school's a place for learning and focus, not for looking at TikTok.
Mm-hmm. All right. That's kind of like beating up on that. We know technology in school is a headache. It's a problem. We've been dealing with it. We know that kids spend a whole lot more time on technology. I mean, I wrote an article many years. I actually did a video. I'll send it to you. I'll send you this video when I get a chance, and which would be after this podcast. It's called "Let's Teach Kids How to Play Again." That's the video. It was an audition for a TEDx talk. I didn't make the cut. But here's what I want to know. You have Camp Light. And I know you strive to help parents. How do you get into schools? How do you make people aware that, you know what, we're an organization that wants to help your kids? How do you get into schools and work with schools to help create awareness about the balance of the digital world and we'll say the real world? How do you do it?
Yeah. So, and you raised an interesting point earlier that this isn't a new problem. We've been dealing with this for a decade, yet it's hasn't been solved. Like most school, like we haven't really found a school in the country that's doing really, really well. There's a couple exceptions, but for the most part, no, everyone's struggling because it constantly evolves. Right. And so, yeah, with schools, we work in sort of three capacities. The main one, you know, we have the student door score. It's this proprietary assessment for how much technology is impacting students' lives. And we license that out to schools. The only way a student can take that is if the school administers it. You can't go online to do it. And that provides just a ton of insights and details to the school. We break it down by gender, by grade level, by theme, whether it's physical health, mental health. So they have all of these insights. Some schools are using that to then go get funding to, you know, boost their mental health program or their digital wellness program. Others, it's for just insights on how can they make calibration. So the student gets a score, it helps them improve. If they want to share it with their parents, they can, but it's totally optional. And then the schools get very detailed reports. That's the main way that we're working with schools right now. Second is some, we go into a deep consulting process where, you know, we're kind of that outside view, having worked with schools in like 90 countries now, saying, look, okay, here's what works. Here's what doesn't work. Let's overhaul your policy and then help evangelize that to the community. That's sort of the second way. Mm-hmm. And the third way, sometimes we'll come in and do public speaking, whether it's with the students or with the faculty or with a town hall format with parents. Mm-hmm. That doesn't scale as well. There's only, you know, so many of us and so many schools, but those are really the three capacities that we work with schools. And that first one, I mean, that's, you know, schools, they need and they want that data. And so that's a fairly easy entry point for us to say, look, like we're going to help your students understand and have perspective on their technology use. And we're also going to help the school identify some problem areas.
And you're in 90 countries now. And do you have maybe this is a bad question, but do you have like a success rate in terms of, you know, we're helping lower or balance the technology versus real world mentality a little bit better?
Yeah. So we just launched the student DORA in the fall. So we don't have that. We don't even have a full school year yet for student DORA. So, and it's so dependent. And we have partners in 90 countries. We don't have schools in 90 countries. Our schools are probably, but still probably north of 40 or so countries. Right. So no, we don't have that data, the before and after. We have, what we do have is really interesting data across tens of thousands of students in aggregate of what they're saying. And I think this is interesting because a lot of parents, most parents, they speak on behalf of the student. The parents think they know what their kids think. And a lot of times we ask parents like, hey, have you asked your child, like, what is it that they feel connected to? Like most parents don't even know how Discord or TikTok work, right? And so we recommend having a conversation with your child, like understand what they're drawn to. What's their social connection? What's their kind of local social currency, right? Mm-hmm. How does that work and how does that operate and how does that function? Most parents don't know that. And so with all of our data from all of these students, we have a much better picture of trends on what's keeping them up at night. Mm-hmm. What are their sentiments towards technology? What are their sentiments towards parents? And we're going to start releasing reports in aggregate and also at the state level. We're going through all that data right now. So we're mm-hmm. close to releasing some really cool research reports.
Mm-hmm. That is the piece that I want to know more about because, you know, like I said, my oldest daughters, they didn't have this. I mean, they found out stuff, but they found out, you know, word of mouth and different things. But you could literally have a kid come home from school, everything's okay, and they either get on their phone or they've been on their phones and on the school bus as well. And they're suffering from anxiety, depression, all kinds of different things. And I really want to know, my whole thing is, what is it? You'll never get an answer. What the hell happened? You come down to the dinner table, you're distraught. You don't want to talk, you know, and I know this is middle school, you know, so this is what middle school does. Middle school kids do this. But there's got to be a worry on the part of some parents, because you hear enough about suicide to, you know, just be aware of it enough to say, I got to find out what's going on, because she looks like she's really upset. So I'm a parent. I come to you and I ask you this question. Do you take individual parents?
Sure. Yeah. No, we work with individual parents on kind of one-on-one consulting. And
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that question, you know, there's a lot to unpack there, because a lot of that starts at a much earlier age, and it's creating that safe space where your child can be really comfortable telling you. But most kids, at least in high school, and this isn't new to technology, but they don't feel comfortable talking to their parents about their concerns, right? And with technology, though, one of the big things, though, is they're afraid of being removed, right? And that's mm-hmm. their main connection to their friends. So you have a daughter, and let's say she's in 10th grade, and she sees something she's really uncomfortable with, whether it's social media or YouTube or whatever. She wishes that she could tell her parents, but she's afraid that if she tells her parents, they're going to react and just take the phone away. And that's a worse outcome for her. So I can't emphasize how important it is to, at a much earlier age — it's harder to just initiate this once they're in 10th grade, but a much earlier age — try to create that space where they could talk to you about anything without judgment, and where mm-hmm. you're more listening, you're asking questions, you're not reacting, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's hard for parents to do, to not be reactionary. But if you could do that, you're going to hopefully have a better chance of them opening up when there's something more serious, when they're in middle school and high school, whether it's bullying or whether it's not understanding a deep fake, or, you know, seeing something, you know, very violent. You want them to be able to talk to you without fear of taking away their main source of connection.
Right, right. Yeah, that makes total sense. That's really good. You know, so what are some networks that parents can use when they're dealing with their kid who's maybe is involved with bullying or who needs help with bullying? Do you deal with that as well?
Yeah, so we're going to be launching soon, like a bully support group for parents. Mm-hmm. We're in kind of beta and testing it out right now. And, you know, it's interesting. It's a thing that everything else regarding technology, you're probably likely to talk to another parent at the soccer game about, like, oh, have you seen this app, or how much screen time do you have? But bullying, that's a very personal and sensitive thing. And so we're working on creating kind of a safe space for parents to be able to connect with other parents, connect with experts. So that's that's in the works right now. It's not ready yet, but we're working on that to kind of create that environment. And then there's a lot of great resources out there. We're going to be launching a library soon for parent resources on digital detox specific to bullying. But bullying is complicated. Like, it's become, you know, much more nuanced. You know, back in the day, right, when we grew up, you know, it was something, you know, very visual. Like, there's a good chance that a parent or a teacher or a student is going to see it. It's on campus, right? Now, like, you're alone in your bedroom at night and no one knows except you. So it's just changed in so many ways. So it's scary. It's very, very scary.
Yeah. My name is Jim Burns. You're listening to the Consistently Fit podcast. We're talking with Forrest Bronson. He's doing unbelievable work. Forrest, give your information out. Where can people find you? That's what I want everyone to know. And I'm going to put everything into the episode description as well.
Yeah, Jim, thanks for having me on the show, and thanks for everything you're doing as well. Digitaldetox.com, that's probably the best way to stay in the loop of what we're doing as a company in the digital wellness space. Mm-hmm. And I'm not very social online. I'm on LinkedIn, Forrest Bronson. You could find me if you want to connect with me directly. Otherwise, mm-hmm. digitaldetox.com. You could sign up for updates, request info if you're involved with a school, et cetera.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from this short podcast, and I think that you need to be on — I hope you're on other podcasts as well, because people need to hear this stuff — what would you want them to take away?
Oh, just one? And if we have time, I'd love to talk briefly about the —
oh, you could talk at length. I don't care. You can do whatever you want. But what is — not one thing, but what would be the main piece that you would want people to take away from this podcast?
So I think if you're a parent listening, it would be that you're not alone. You know, this is uncharted territory. It's messy. We're not going to all get it right. We're going to mess up. So we need to have empathy towards each other, but we also need to be very practical and vigilant about this. And I encourage parents to look at technology with an open lens. And what I mean by that is we're starting to see divisions in this, which shouldn't be the case, right? We're seeing very extreme ends where it's, you know, that the first sign of anything negative, let's take away everything and shut it down. And that doesn't seem quite like the right answer, right? And then we see the other extreme end where it's, okay, we're just going to let you watch TikTok all day long in kindergarten and have zero guardrails. And that's not quite the right answer. So we need to find a balance that's reasonable. Like, this is the era we live in, like it or not. You could wish it away. It's not going to go away. So we could deal with it head on, and we could make practical, pragmatic decisions. Or we could be very reactionary and reactive, and that's probably not going to be healthy. Or we could just not really care, and that's not going to be healthy either. So I just encourage parents to try to take that middle ground and empathize. Mm-hmm. That would be one. Second, and you know, we didn't talk about it, it's actually a great fit for the your new show, the fitness side. And I want to just raise up a couple of interesting points. So with our student Dora, and you know, tens of thousands of students have taken this, we found that it's something like 90% are scrolling right before bed, and north of 30% are checking notifications in the middle of the night. So they're waking up to check a notification. Those are two of the worst things you could do for sleep, right? Mm-hmm. And now we have undebatable studies showing how critical sleep is for physical health, for blood glucose control, for insulin control, everything. So that would be one of the biggest direct takeaways I would tell parents. Look, mm-hmm. of all the things you're going to debate with your kids on screen time, on what they watch, et cetera, one that shouldn't be up for negotiation is sleep hygiene, right? Mm-hmm. And for that, we should be cutting off, if possible, 2 hours before bed any technology. If you can't do that, then an hour, right? Mm-hmm. And we should not be waking up in the middle of the night unless you're a physician on call. This applies to adults too. You shouldn't mm-hmm. be checking the phone in the middle of the night, full stop, right? Mm-hmm. So that would be something I would hope everyone could get on board with. And you just have to put on your parent shoes and enforce that, because otherwise it's going to have detrimental health, mental health, and physical health impacts on your child's development.
One of the things that we do here is we take the phone, iPad, and Apple laptop. We take everything. It comes into our room. So our daughter has no access to it at night. I do remember when the phone was something that my middle daughter was using, and having that in my bedroom years ago, it went off all night through text messaging. And the last text message that came through, which came through dozens of times, was, "Where are you? Where are you?" In other words, why aren't you answering? I mean, I'm asleep. Right. I mean, that's where I am. But the bottom line is, you know, that's where you should be too. You know, it's amazing what does go on in the middle of the night and how some kids are up virtually all night. And it's no wonder you talk about sleep hygiene. It's no wonder you have cranky kids, crabby kids, kids that you tell them to do something, they start telling you, you know, they're disrespectful, irresponsible. They're tired. They're tired because of what they're doing, you know, and they're not getting 8 to 9 hours of sleep.
No, absolutely. And so if we're going to go down the complicated route, and I'd love, you know, Dr. Gupta on this show, she's a consulting pediatric endocrinologist, but you know, what we're learning about sleep and the endocrine system and sleep and insulin resistance and insulin control is just absolutely massive. It's just so critical. But putting aside the complex side, just looking very basic, one thing that gets through when we're talking to parents is if they have a student athlete, and this should apply to anyone, whether you're in the school play or you're, you know, studying to be the valedictorian, all of this is critical for sleep. But for some reason, the athletic side kind of clicks through with parents. And my argument is your child will never reach their full athletic potential if they're not maximizing their sleep game. Full stop. And that's not saying that they won't become a tremendous athlete. They might be great. Shoot, maybe they'll go to college and play, but they're not going to reach their full potential. So during that development, just in terms of muscle atrophy and muscle recovery, sleep is so, so critical. And if you're going to mess that up by checking unneeded notifications in the middle of the night, that's really going to impact your athletic ability.
Yeah. And there's also indicators that, you know, sleep deprivation impacts your weight. It impacts your
100%.
weight, you know, and you said, you know, in terms of insulin and so on. And we have this big debate going on, like, why do we have so much teenage obesity and diabetes? Maybe we need to check on how much those kids are sleeping. That may answer some questions for us.
Well, you know, I mean, the science is undebatable that, lack of sleep, and there's been study after study that's been repeated on this, impacts your insulin sensitivity, which ultimately impacts your ability to process glucose and impacts obesity and prediabetes. So yeah, I think there's a direct connection there with that epidemic with teens and lack of sleep. Now, phones aren't the only reason for lack of sleep, right? Like, there's a lot of other sleep hygiene that needs to go into place. There's a lot of other stressors in the world right now that are impacting sleep and other anxieties. But the one thing that is in our control for most of us should be how we use technology before sleep, during sleep, and right when you wake up in the morning.
Forrest, I'm going to ask you, is there anything else that you would like to share? I know you do have plenty on your mind, but is there anything specific that you'd like to share on this podcast? I'd love to have you back on. There's so much more that you, I know you got a lot kicking around in that mind of yours, because I could see it, but is there anything else you'd like to share right now?
I think we had a pretty good crash course today. We talked about schools. We talked about young children, older children, parents, et cetera. I'd say the last thing on the parenting side, and again, like, I'm a parent of a fourth and first grader, so I'm in the thick of it. And for parents, one feedback we get from a lot of students in high school is that their parents constantly say, you know, stop spending all this time on their phone, stop spending all this time on their phone. But then the parent is there just scrolling Facebook or Instagram reels all day on the couch on the weekend. So I would just be very careful about what you're asking your child to do and look inward at how you're modeling that behavior. And you can't expect them to do something that you're not modeling. It's just, it doesn't work that way. So as hard as it is, I think many parents, myself included, can benefit from just taking a personal audit and saying, okay, how can I improve so I can better model the behavior that I hope my child emulates?
You know, I'm just going to share this real quick. If you want to have an eye-opening experience, I have a 34-year-old daughter tomorrow. She'll be 34. I have a 28-year-old daughter, and I've seen, I've observed my own mistakes in their behavior right now. I've observed it. And then you have a 13-year-old, and you're watching that, and you're saying to yourself, how am I going to avoid a reoccurrence of this? And it has nothing to do with that kid. It has nothing to do with the 13. It has everything to do with me. So if in fact I want to make the same mistakes again, it becomes like a dog going back to his vomit. You know, it's like you keep returning to the same stuff. And that idea that if you keep doing the same thing over and over again, you're always going to get what you've always gotten. That's all there is to it. And, so when you have those older kids and you're looking at them, and then all of a sudden you got the younger kid and you're saying, uh-oh, I saw that 10 years ago or 15 years ago, it can be frightening. It can be frightening. And you'll start probably fourth grade, so that's like 10. And then first grade is like 6. So when one of them's like 15, the other one's going to be 11, and you're going to remember how you handled the fifth, how you handled that this one when you were 11, and here's this what this looks like. Now here comes this other one down the pike. How am I going to do this? It just seems to be something that happens, and it's, I guess that's why kids are individuals, and they're one way, or you know, and another kid's another way. That's just all there is to it. But it did scare me. I have to tell you, it did scare me, and it's something that I work on. Strictly because I don't want to make the same mistakes again.
Well, so the good news, we could, today is always a new day. We could always improve. All of us have room to improve. So I think it just takes the work to look inward and kind of take that inventory.
Amen. I knew there was a reason I liked you. Forrest, I thank you. Please don't leave when I stop the recording. It has been my pleasure speaking with you. I hope we can do it again. You're a wonderful guest. My name is Jim Burns. You've been listening to Consistently Fit, the Consistently Fit podcast. We just got through talking with Forrest Bronson. Wonderful interview. And I thank all you folks who are going to be listening to this. You will be listening, and you're going to want to save this one because it's excellent. Forrest, thanks again.
Jim, thanks for having me.